Thank you, Maharaj. My greetings to everyone, our revered Swamiji's, dear brothers, dear sisters, dear friends. This is really a very wonderful occasion. I grew up in the Jewish tradition. I don't know if I was chosen for that reason or it's a nice coincidence, but but this was something very special for me because the Jewish tradition holds a very special place in my heart. And if I had heard the Swami speak when I was a younger man, perhaps I would have been there. And if he had gone to India when he was a younger man, as I did, perhaps he would be here now. So we don't know why and how these things work. But in any event, I enjoyed very much hearing about this mystical tradition of Judaism. Unfortunately, we don't hear enough about it, as with many of the other traditions of the world. This topic was assigned to us. I don't know if I would have chosen it. I had a little trouble trying to figure out how to deal with it at first. The first question was, are we talking about two separate things, philosophical tradition and a mystical tradition? Are they two aspects of one thing? This Vedanta is a little bit difficult to understand sometimes because it's all-inclusive, and yet neither term actually will explain it. Very often I find myself asked the question, is Vedanta a philosophy or a religion? And it's the same dilemma. If we say, well, it's a philosophy, that doesn't tell the whole story. If it's a religion, that's too constricting. And if we say both, that's also confusing. Neither is also confusing. So we have this dilemma with Vedanta. But in any event, I thought I would try to approach this by discussing both a philosophical side and a mystical side. And I wanted to begin with a little bit of historical or interreligious type of interpretation, take that approach, so we can see how this distinction works in other religions. If we see how it works in other traditions, it's a little bit easier for us to get a handle on how this distinction may work in the tradition of Vedanta. I also got this idea that I would somehow weave this talk around something that Swami Vivekananda used to say very often. He had a very nice way of explaining religion in terms of two things, being and becoming. When we go through the complete works of Swami Vivekananda, now we have 9 volumes. Swami Vivekananda was a direct disciple of Sri Ramakrishna who came to this country for the World Parliament of Religions in Chicago in 1893. And we, of course, owe him a great debt of gratitude. He was the one who established our Ramakrishna order. So in any event, he used this term quite often. We find 9 different occasions in the complete works where he used it. That means that he must have uttered these words many, many other times that weren't recorded, maybe in private conversation or in other teachings. I'll give just a couple of short examples. In his lecture on bhakti or devotion, he says, religion is not in doctrines, in dogmas, nor in intellectual argumentation. It is being and becoming. It is realization. And in the claims of religion, he said, stand up and reason out, having no blind faith. Religion is a question of being and becoming, not of believing. This is religion, and when you have attained to that, you have religion. Now, I chose this particular phrase because I want to try to analyze the philosophy as belonging to the being part and the mysticism as belonging to the becoming part. It's not a perfect analogy, and it doesn't work in every aspect, but it gives us a handle. It gives us something to start with. We can look at the philosopher as confining himself or herself to this realm of existence, how things are, the aspect of being. something permanent, something unchanging. Now, someone may say, well, what about the Buddhist philosophy that will say everything is changing? That's also a kind of fixed doctrine. So we have this idea that from a philosophical point of view, we'll be able to say something that will give us some idea of an established truth that may become doctrine. Unfortunately, it may also become dogma sometimes, but in any case, we'll have some fixed kind of philosophical doctrine, some theories of metaphysics, some rational explanations, some argumentation, some logical reasoning, all of which we can say belongs to philosophy and belongs to this idea of being. Now, the mystical side is the other side of the coin. This is change. This is transformation. This is that radical opening and awakening of the heart, where we start at one point and we go to another point. This is the experience of grace. This is the experience of the divine within. This is process and change. So we can say in a single word, becoming. So if we take these two sides together, being and becoming, the philosophical side and the mystical side, and we can somehow get them to work together, we get a good handle on Swami Vivekananda's view of Vedanta and of religion in general. So the statement of Swami Vivekananda is of course, a wonderful statement, but it's nice that we see this combination, not an either-or. We see that both of these are necessary to form some kind of dynamic whole. Each one has a role to play. So I'll try to use this as our starting point, this idea of being and becoming. Now, when we speak about mysticism or the mystical tradition, what exactly do we mean? If we want to try to give a very general definition, we can come up with some very basic ideas that seem to work for most, if not all, mystical traditions. I turn to that great expert on religion, Google, to get this definition, which seems to work very well. Really, I don't know how we prepared talks before we had this internet and Google. Anyhow, what it says is, it is the phenomenon, mysticism, it is the phenomenon of the adherent having a unique experience of communion with God, an ultimate reality, divinity, or insight into spiritual truths. Now, why unique? Unique, I think, in the sense of something rare. We'll find that in the Vedantic view and in most mystical traditions, it's open to everyone. Not unique in that it can only happen to one person and not another person, but it happens to a rare, relatively small number of people who have received a special kind of grace. This idea of grace is very important in the mystical tradition. It may be grace from a personal God, it may be from the cosmos, but something greater than ourselves and something which pulls us up. This idea of grace doesn't have to be restricted to this idea of the personal God. The idea of grace comes because, first of all, we have to disappear. This I has to step aside before that grace can be experienced. And the experience of grace is always far greater than anything we did to earn that. So we never feel that it's the result of our own practice. We feel somehow that we've been pulled into something higher and greater than ourselves that cannot be explained. So this idea of grace is present in every tradition, whether that term is used or not, and especially in these mystical traditions. This experience of the mystical realm may also come from those who have a tremendous longing. Of course, Sri Ramakrishna emphasized that idea, this tremendous longing for God realization, which makes us forget everything else, which makes us not care for anything else. That itself and the intensity of spiritual practice, the longing of the heart, the intensity of prayer, may bring about this mystical experience. It may be through certain different types of spiritual practice which are outside the realm of traditional religious spiritual practice. We can think of perhaps the Sufis, the dervishes, with the dance that will get them in some higher state of mind. We can think of the desert fathers with their extreme asceticism, living in solitude, fasting, practicing long hours of prayer and reflection and meditation. So we find different ways of this mystical tradition manifesting itself and different ways of attaining that mystical experience. Now, there are certain elements of the mystical side of every tradition that are universal. And one of these is that mystical traditions deal with the divine in a way that is entirely universal. All of the distinctions that we find in particular religious traditions dissolve. They disappear in that higher mystical experience. So the external trappings, the language that's used, the rituals, the rites, everything, become perfectly secondary. And in that higher experience, there's a unity. There's a very common theme in all religious traditions. Sri Ramakrishna used to say that there all jackals howl alike. It's a very nice way of putting it. If we put all of the saints and sages from all of the different traditions, God-realized souls, we'll find that they speak the same language. Now, it doesn't mean that they have exactly the same experience or that the mystical experience takes place in the same way. It may be a flash. It may be a sudden type of experience. It may be a gradual going deeper and deeper and deeper. It may come through a meditative experience where the mind goes into a state of samadhi. It may come just in a flash of insight. Tattvamasi, thou art that. We have that experience. But there'll be a perfect understanding among all of these great souls that they're talking about the same ultimate reality, however it's expressed. So this is one of the very important elements of the mystical experience, the commonality, the universality of it. Now, if we look at the three main religious traditions that grew out of the Middle East, starting with Judaism and Christianity and then Islam, we find that they all had, at different periods, a very vigorous and very strong mystical traditions. We've just heard so much about the Kabbalah and the Hasidic tradition within Judaism. This was a very vibrant and strong tradition for many centuries. The Christian mystics, who were very often monks and nuns, had taken their monastic vows and very often raised to sainthood. They represent a very strong and important element, especially in the Catholic Church. And then the Sufi tradition within Islam. These, of course, are the ones that we know about, but every religion has its little, almost cults, we can say, different groups that have kind of strayed away a little bit out of the mainstream, where they may operate underground. They'll have their own esoteric teachings. They'll have their own language, their own symbolism and everything, all striving to have some higher type of mystical experience. Now, if we look at the relationship between the mystical side and the conventional side of these religions, and I'm half identifying the conventional side with the philosophical side. It's, as I say, it's not a perfect split that we have. But in any event, we'll find that there's an orthodox side and then this mystical side. Now, the relationship between one side and the other in these three great religions, we say of the West, that came out of the Middle East, we find that it's always been a bit of a challenge. There's always been a bit of a love-hate relationship between the orthodox side of the religion and the mystical side. And at different times, religions have embraced the mystical side, and at other times it's been the exact opposite. There's been really an antagonistic relationship. So we see someone like St. John of the Cross. We wonder how St. John of the Cross could have been thrown in a dungeon during his lifetime and later made into considered a saint. We see with many of the great Sufis that they were excommunicated. They were considered to be kafir, to be heretics, because they experienced that oneness in a tradition that was more basically a dualistic tradition. So we find at different periods an embracing of the mystics and of the saints and a distancing. We see both of them together in all of these different religions. In Judaism, this Kabbalah and the Hasidic tradition, there were several centuries, I hope I'll get this right, Rabbi, where it was almost mainstream. It was such an important element with this idea of reincarnation, with this idea of a very traditional type of teaching with the Hasidic master passing on the teaching to a disciple. The same thing we have in the yogic traditions, Vedantic traditions. I'm reminded of the second half of the story that I think the rabbi started to tell, and again, I may get it wrong, so forgive me. But I think it was also the Baal Shem Tov, when he was a young boy, that somebody asked him, teasing him, he was very young, and said, if you can tell me where God is, then I'll give you, what, a shekel, something like that. So the young boy said to whoever it was, I'll give you a shekel if you can tell me where God is not. So is that close?
Very close.
Close to the story. We can get the real story in the question and answer. And in Islam, which many people don't realize, there was a period, this golden period, from the 13th century to the 16th century, where the Sufi culture was the predominant culture. And it was really because of that culture that the religion spread. We know some of it was with the sword, but a lot of it was with the great learning. When a great deal of Europe was really in the Middle Ages, when there wasn't much going on in terms of culture and philosophical thought, this Moorish culture was very important. And the Sufi tradition is really tremendously cultured, high-cultured tradition of poetry and song. We know that Swami Vivekananda himself, from his father also, was very, very fond of many of these Sufi songs. And the Sufis in India in particular are hardly distinguishable from those following the Vedantic traditions. Also, what we heard this morning, really, how can we think of any difference between these teachings of Kabbalah and Vedanta? So we really have a wonderful illustration of how two jackals are speaking the same, howling alike. I remember once, with regard to Islam, I was attending an interreligious conference in Southern California. And there was a representative of Islam there. And I was curious. I asked him, how do members of the Muslim community look upon Sufis? Because we hear both ways. We know that they're a little bit outside of the mainstream, and yet there's also some type of respect for them, and on some level, the highest respect. So he gave a very interesting answer. He said, within the heart of every Muslim is a little bit of Sufi. Yeah. So even if they can't say it out loud, even if they come from a very orthodox tradition, because there are some differences in the experiences and ideas of the Sufis from the mainstream Islam. Just as we saw there are differences between the Kabbalistic interpretations of Torah and the traditional interpretations. So we see even in countries, there are some Islamic countries today where the Sufi sects are outlawed and banned. Even in those countries, they'll read Sufi poetry and have the highest regard for that. So we have this love-hate relationship. and different periods of time where they were closer together and different periods of time where they were separate. Now, what about Vedanta? The first thing that I should really admit is that it's an unfair comparison, because many people will say Vedanta itself is the mystical side or the philosophical side. We very often say that. People say, well, what is Vedanta? We'll say the philosophical side of Hinduism. It's also the mystical side of Hinduism. So it's really a bit of an unfair comparison to talk about this relationship between philosophy and mysticism, or conventional and mystical side. But even if we, just for the sake of argument, speak in terms of Hinduism, and if we speak of Hinduism, we can say also the offshoots, children of Hinduism, Buddhism, Jainism, to a certain extent, Sikhism and other religions of the Far East, we find that there really was never a period where there was any antagonistic relationship. In India especially, the mystics were always held to represent the very highest level of the goal of all of the spiritual traditions within India. So in that sense, we can say that Vedanta represents both the mystical tradition and the philosophical tradition in a way that harmonizes them. So we don't see this tension that exists in some other religions. Vedanta, of course, has a conventional side to it, because in Vedanta we do make use of some of the rites and rituals of Hinduism. But we understand that they have a role to play. And ultimately, this mystical goal will be the defining principle of religion, as Swamiji himself said. So we see in India that these great mystics represent the ideal. If we look at the different conceptions of God that we have in the Hindu tradition, and just for a moment try to understand this wonderful conception of God as Shiva. Now, those of us who grew up in the West, for us it's a very remarkable thing. If we think of God in some human form, it'll be an old man with a beard sitting on a throne. The very traditional idea. Now, what do we find with Shiva? He's half mad. He's smoking hemp. He's going around with ashes on his body. Where does he live? In the cremation ground. Right? Half the time he's unconscious of the world, neglecting his family. Right? And then the other half of the time he's singing and dancing, taking the name of Rama. Now, this is the ideal of the personal God, actually the ideal yogi, that we try to emulate Shiva, but also he's a worship. This is a symbolic conception of God, both personal and impersonal. So if a tradition can have that as part of the orthodox conception of God, then we see there can't be too much of a break, of a gap between the conventional and the mystical side of the religion. Now, another thing we should understand is that this doesn't mean that there's not a separate philosophical tradition, and that tradition doesn't have its own distinctive features, because there is a tradition of philosophical thought and speculation within Vedanta, and there are some very important distinctions and some very stark differences. When we speak of the philosophical tradition within Vedanta, sometimes we say Upanishads. We'll say the Upanishads, from the Vedic tradition, the Gita, the Brahma Sutras, all of these things represent, we call it Prasthanatraya, the three pillars of Vedanta, that this will represent the philosophical side. Strictly speaking, I would say that these great scriptures, especially the Upanishads and Gita, represent equally the mystical side and the philosophical side. if we really want to talk about the philosophical tradition within Vedanta, we have to go to the commentaries. We have to go to the great philosophers, the Acharyas, Shankaracharya, Ramanuja, Madhva. These are the ones who really developed a specific philosophical systems and with differences. One of the things we saw about the mystics is they all agree. One of the things we find about the philosophers is they all disagree. they want to prove that they're right, and they want to argue against the others, and they want to establish their own position. So this was a very strong part of the philosophical tradition in India. This idea of vigorous debate, this idea of refutation, of establishing one's own position by refuting the views of the others. Now, the greatest, perhaps, of all of these philosophers was Shankaracharya. And he set the standard for everything in this philosophical tradition. It's because of Shankaracharya that after him, everyone had to write commentaries on Upanishads, on Gita, on Brahma Sutra. Whatever he did had to be followed by the others. His role was so important, and really in the whole history of Indian thought, Vedantic thought, Shankaracharya occupies a place that almost no one else occupies. We can say Buddha, he revolutionized things from one period of time. Shankaracharya, in a sense, reestablished everything. He took the ancient traditions and reestablished them at a time when it was necessary for someone like him to come. So what we find in this philosophical side of Vedanta, everything is based on interpretation. Everything has to go back to scripture. We have this idea, Shruti, that the Vedic scriptures, especially the Upanishads, have a special authority, and nothing can contradict them. So every system has to be based on the great statements that we find in the Upanishads. So Shankaracharya wrote commentaries on the main Upanishads. Why do we call them the main Upanishads? Because he wrote commentaries on them. He was that important that if he wrote a commentary on something, then that was the stamp of authority. I was told once by one of my old professors that there was a period when people believed that Shankaracharya wrote the Gita. So some old scholars, his commentary was so important and it raised the status of Gita so much just because of its commentary that there was some speculation among some scholars that he actually wrote it. We know, of course, it's not true, but it just shows the tremendous importance of Shankaracharya. So during his lifetime, we saw a beautiful play yesterday that the youth group put on the life of Shankaracharya. We see that he engaged in debate against all of the other philosophical schools at that time in India. So that meant there were Buddhist scholars, there were scholars of Sankhya, Mimamsa, and other schools. And it was his task, really, as given to him by his own guru, to establish his position. His position was his own interpretation of the Upanishads based on some of these great statements, which we call Mahavakyas. So he interpreted the Upanishads from a non-dualistic point of view, and this was the stance that he took, and he was a tremendous thinker, incredible intellect. He was able to more or less defeat all of the others, and really was responsible for a tremendous revolution and reestablishment in India of Vedanta. Not only that, he organized an entire monastic tradition and even methods of worship, Shanmata. There's different ways in which gods and goddesses are worshipped within Hinduism. He was responsible for reestablishing all of these things. Now, to go through the entire philosophy of the three different schools is a very big thing. I'll try to, just in a nutshell, explain the position of Shankaracharya. It falls very much within this idea of being, because it establishes Brahman. Brahman, that infinite, absolute, impersonal reality. Sometimes we can think of it as the Godhead, that which is unchanging, transcendent. That's the sole reality. That alone has the right to be called something real. We have this visible universe. It's nothing but that same Brahman appearing to us through Maya, through ignorance, as something external. It's a Brahman plus name and form. But the most important part of his teaching is this relationship between this infinite absolute reality and the self within. Shankaracharya's position is a very radical position. The self is not an emanation from God. It's not breathed into us from God. It's absolutely one. If we think of the analogy of a dream, we say, I had a dream last night. I had a dream that I was a king. Now, the I who had the dream and the I who was the king, does one come from the other? Is one an emanation from the other? It's the same I. So the same Brahman that's projecting this, the dreaming this whole universe, is entering into that dream. The same Brahman is really, under the spell of Maya, identified with the character in the dream, but one with the dreamer. So there's a very radical identification. So that means we're not seeking union with God. We're trying to realize our oneness with God, which is present here and now, only we don't know it. So this is, in a nutshell, the position of Shankaracharya. Bondage is the result of ignorance, where we have this ignorance of who we are. If it's the result of ignorance, then liberation or enlightenment can come only from knowledge. Nothing can remove ignorance but knowledge. Nothing can remove darkness but light. That means that rites and rituals, even devotional practices, they have a value insofar as they purify the heart. They have a value insofar as they can raise our consciousness. But ultimately, it's knowledge alone. So this was the tradition of Shankaracharya. And it's very radical. It involves extreme non-attachment. We have to, from the very beginning, say, no, I'm not this body. I'm not even this mind. I'm not this ego. We have to give up that association and attachment. So traditionally, it involved a great deal of renunciation and very often was felt to be the domain of those who had renounced the world, the monks and nuns who lived in such a way that they would form no attachment. In extreme cases, they wouldn't even stay in the same place more than 3 nights just to avoid that attachment. So with a very radical philosophy, very difficult for most people to follow, but brilliant. If we just think of it in terms of the sheer intellectual brilliance of it, we have to stand in awe of the thinking of Shankaracharya. Now, the problem is that the Upanishads speak many times in parables. They speak allegorically. We find this infinite absolute Brahman getting bored, sitting in meditation and thinking, oh, I wish I were many so that I would have something to do, and that's how the universe came into being. Things that we can't possibly take literally, but have a great symbolic value for us. Now, my point is that there are statements in the Upanishads which give room for different interpretations. So we don't have to say that Shankaracharya's interpretation is the only interpretation. And actually, we find that the Brahman of the Upanishads is a little bit more versatile than Shankaracharya as a Brahman. He can do a little bit. He can project things. Shankaracharya doesn't want Brahman to do anything. He paints him into a corner a little bit. It's very hard for him to explain this universe without this Maya theory and everything. But there are other ways of looking at the Brahman as having this Shakti, this Chit Shakti, this power to project this universe and enter into the universe and be present in the universe and dwell within all beings as the real self within everyone. Of course, Shankaracharya accepts all of these things on different levels. But we find that the other two of the other great teachers, Ramanuja and Madhva, they can find scope for their philosophy and they can find references in the Upanishads to back their ideas, to back their philosophy. In fact, they'll say that we're not starting with a philosophy and finding something to prove it. This is our interpretation of the scriptures and the Upanishads. So we find Ramanuja. Shankaracharya is Advaita Vedanta, Ramanuja, Vishishta Advaita Vedanta, qualified non-dualism. That means that the individual soul and this universe are considered to be attributes of Brahman. They inhere in Brahman. They come from Brahman, but they dwell within Brahman. Just as we have a physical body, we have a mind, and that higher self dwells within. So the Brahman dwells within this universe. So there's a certain reality to this universe, and there's a certain separation, this relationship of part to whole. Each individual self, jiva, is a part of that combined great soul, that supreme self, which we call Brahman. So we find that we have a slightly lower level where the individual soul can enter into a state of union. This individual soul is part of God. We can find verses in the Upanishads which will seem to verify this position. And it's a very beautiful position. Then we get to Madhva. He also can justify his dualistic position. We find in the Upanishad verses that talk about individual souls flying out of fire as sparks. Just as a spark will fly out of the fire, that means we come from God, we come from Brahman. We're made of the same stuff, basically, this consciousness, this fire, but then we have a separate existence. So we have these different schools. Swami Vivekananda, he used to be a little bit annoyed at all of them for text torturing, he used to say. Yeah, they all want to prove that what I say is right, so the verses they don't like, they'll twist a little bit. But they had no choice. And it also shows, really, their reverence for Shruti, their reverence for Scripture, and this firm belief that they all had that Scripture can't contradict itself. It has to say the same thing from beginning to end. So we can forgive them a little bit on that, but it's true. There's some verses that we would like to say, yes, it's a very beautiful explanation of a dualistic position. Why not accept it that way? Or a qualified non-dualistic position. But they were philosophers, after all. So this was the way it worked. There were rules in those days, and they had no choice. Now, in fairness to all of them, I just want to say a few words, because they were also great souls. The Shankaracharya, Ramanuja, Madhva, they all renounced everything in search for truth, in search for God. And Shankaracharya, he had two sides to him. We see this one side, which is sometimes called vada. Vada means arguing, establishing a certain position where you have to defeat your opponents. And the other side, the other type of literature, can be called upadesha, instruction, spiritual instruction. And we find this in many of his poems and his treatises, which are very beautiful, which give great scope for devotion. We have his beautiful hymn, Bhaja Govindam, which really establishes the transitory nature of life, the transitory nature of the world, the need to call on God, however we understand God, the need to try to realize something because time is flying by. This life is a very short thing, and we shouldn't waste a moment of it. So we have that side of Shankaracharya, which is in stark contrast to this argumentative side, where he's trying to defeat everyone. We have this other side. Ramanuja also, the one story that is very often told about him was about his initiation. When he received the mantra, he was told not to reveal that mantra to anyone else. So he said, why? And his guru said, well, if you reveal it to anyone else, They may get liberation also, but you'll go to hell. Yeah. Now, this Ramanuja, just to show what a great soul he was, he immediately began telling everyone this mantra. He was willing to go to hell in order to liberate others. So these dry philosophers weren't dry philosophers. This was only one side. This is what they had to do. This is what the tradition expected them to do. But Madhva also laid the ground for a tremendous amount of devotion. And they all had their monastic traditions also that followed them. So we find that they represented this philosophical tradition, but we can't say it was completely divorced from this mystical tradition. Now, I want to go more directly to the mystical side. That was the philosophical side. And here we can go from this being aspect to the becoming aspect. Now, this being and becoming. Sometimes Swamiji would say things, Swami Vivekananda would say things that were confusing. In fact, very often he would say things. Some of his brother disciples used to say, well, you say this today, tomorrow you'll say something else. We don't know what you believe. And when we read Swami Vivekananda's lectures on bhakti, we think, well, everything was devotion. Such a sweet, loving heart. When we read Jnana Yoga, everything was, I am that self. Well, who is God? I myself am the highest God. We think, how can it be the same person? But there was a consistency to Swamiji's thought. There was a great consistency that sometimes only he understood because he saw everything from a very high level. So sometimes he would say confusing things. One of his most famous statements also was a little bit confusing if we really think about it. We've heard this in Vedanta many, many times. Each soul is potentially divine. The goal is to manifest this divinity within by controlling nature, external and internal. Do this either by work or worship or psychic control or philosophy, by one or more or all of these, and be free. This is the whole of religion. Doctrines or dogmas or rituals or books or temples or forms are but secondary details. Now, what's the confusing part of this? Why does Swamiji say each soul is potentially divine when we know that he says over and over and over again, tell yourself that you're one with the Brahman, already perfect. Why potentially divine? Because there's this gap between being and becoming, between philosophy and mysticism, this gap between what is the metaphysical truth and what is our present understanding. We're potentially divine because we haven't realized that we're already divine. We're not trying to become something that we aren't already in reality. It's already an established fact. This is one of the very basic truths of Vedanta. I sometimes think of the distinction between these mystical traditions and other traditions as the difference between baseball and football. Now, in football, you start at one side of the field, and what do? You try to get to the other side, right, to score a touchdown. In baseball, you start at home plate. What are you trying to do? Get back to home plate. We're trying to get to the spot where we're already standing. Right. But we can't simply stand there and touch on home plate and say, oh, home run. We have to go around all of the bases. So potentially we're already there, but we still have to go all the way around. So both are true. Should I stop now? I had an experience in Bangladesh once. There was a speaker who was speaking, and he was going on a little bit too much. Everyone started clapping, so I was confused. And then somebody explained to me that meant they want him to stop. Anyhow, I'll keep going. Yeah. So this mystical tradition is one where we're trying to transform. There is this idea of becoming, this idea of transformation. Now, one of the essential elements of the mystical tradition, we heard it in the Judaic tradition also, is that we cannot reach it with this ordinary mind. This mind functions within a particular realm. We have to go beyond that realm, some type of super-rational state. And this is why I say that the Upanishads are equally mystical, because they also say that. And Swamiji once said about the whole Vedic tradition, these are the only scriptures that tell you to go beyond the scriptures. And just as he says, it's good to be born in a church, but not to die in a church. We start with things, we have to transcend them. So we read in the Upanishads that Brahman is that ultimate reality from which mind and speech return baffled. They can't reach it. It's beyond the realm of mind and speech. Sri Ramakrishna used to say that everything has become defiled by the tongue. In India, if anything touches the tongue, it can't be used for anything else. It becomes defiled. Now, what he meant was everything else can be explained. We can use words. Words also touch the tongue. No one can explain what Brahman is. So Brahman is pure that way. So he meant also the same thing, that what Brahman is cannot be uttered by the tongue. This ultimate reality is beyond the ability of the mind to grasp. But Sri Ramakrishna used to add this ordinary mind. There's a purified mind. There's a mind that can be raised to a higher level, that can have that experience. Because ultimately everything happens through the mind. Even if it's this mind which is not our ordinary mind, this mind which goes beyond all logical methods of thinking and time, space, and causation, even that mind is the mind we use to realize God. Swami Vivekananda also said that, but he had a little footnote that he would add. The highest truth is beyond reason, but it will never contradict reason. And he was very much against all sorts of superstition and mystery mongering and everything. He really tried, on some level, to demystify this mystical experience. Now, the greatest representative or example of this mystical side of spiritual life, for me at least, is Sri Ramakrishna himself. Sri Ramakrishna was the living example of how religion can be something tangible, that it's a question of direct experience. Now, we shouldn't think, because of this, that somehow Sri Ramakrishna didn't quite reach the mark to be a philosopher, that these ideas were too difficult for him. He was unlettered. He could barely read and write. But he had such a tremendous mind, such a facile mind, that he could play with these philosophical ideas like children play with toys, like a great sculptor will mold a sculpture. He could play with these ideas. We don't find a single philosophical concept that he couldn't explain in the simplest terms. So he had that brilliant intellect. Swami Vivekananda, as young Narendra, his mind, we know, was something unbelievable. He had to sit at the feet of the same unlettered Brahmin priest and learn these highest truths. So it wasn't that Sri Ramakrishna didn't have that very deep, subtle understanding of the teachings of Vedanta, but he understood that we have to go beyond them. He understood the limitations. He understood both the importance of philosophy and the limitations of philosophy. Sometimes he would compare the scriptures to a shopping list. He used to give the story that a man was supposed to go shopping. In India, very often the wife will make a shopping list and send the husband out shopping. Yeah, so they would stay at home and he would go to the market. So this man had this list. He was supposed to buy a certain amount of cloth and some sugar, some flour, some sweets, all different things. But he lost it. Now, he's running around searching for the list because he can't buy anything unless he has the list. Then finally, he sees the list and he reads it and he knows what he has to get, then he throws it away. So this is the value of the scriptures. We need them. They have to explain to us what it is that we're trying to accomplish. We have to have some idea of that. We have to have some understanding of how we achieve that. But ultimately, we have to accomplish it. So we take this philosophical side as far as we can. We use our understanding. We use the mind as far as we can. Then we try to achieve something higher than that. So Sri Ramakrishna always emphasized this idea of attainment, of realization, of experience, which for him was a blissful experience, not a dry experience. This Brahman is not this dry, infinite absolute. Swami Vivekananda used to talk about this bloodless absolute. It referenced the Hegelian philosophy. He said the bloodless absolute is nothing like that. This Brahman is the source of all bliss. And Sri Ramakrishna himself was the proof of that. He would go into this ecstatic state, and his face would be shining with joy, shining with bliss, so much that he couldn't contain himself. We hear the description sometime like a ripe melon that is so ripe that it breaks open, that as if the bliss couldn't stay within him, that it would be breaking through and shining through. This was the experience, that mystical experience that he had, and he wanted to have everyone else experience this. Now, Sri Ramakrishna had a very beautiful understanding of the philosophical side and a very nice way of harmonizing the different schools of Vedanta, the different philosophies, the different ways of worship, even different religious traditions. He used to see everything as a question of attitude, a question of understanding, a question of taste. We all have a different capacity for understanding. We all have a different nature. Some of us are more philosophical. Some of us are more devotional. There'll be a different path for us that will be most helpful for us. This is how he would judge a different tradition, a different path. Not that one is right or one is wrong or one can refute the other. Each one is there because it serves a purpose. So he used to give the illustration, which, you know, in Bengal they're fish eaters. I'm very happy that Sri Ramakrishna was born in Bengal, so that I get to eat fish sometime. But he used to give the example of a mother who buys a fish for the family. One great big fish. But she knows that she has children who have different capacities. Say she has five different children. Some of them like very spicy food. One of them likes fried fish. One of them has a weak stomach. It has to be made with stew type of fish stew. So she'll make different types of dishes based on the power of digestion and the taste of her different children. So this is how Sri Ramakrishna saw all the different traditions of the world, all the different religions of the world. Each one is suited to a different type of taste and a different type of temperament. Sri Ramakrishna used to give the illustration also of water, taking water from a pond. It's the same water, that same ultimate reality, but it takes the shape of the container that we use to draw that water. If we take it in a bucket, it'll take the shape of a bucket. We use a pitcher, the shape of a pitcher. We give it a different name, but it's the same substance. So all different religious traditions, all different spiritual attitudes, at the heart of it is that same ultimate reality. He had that clear understanding, and he explained it in a very nice way. So we can see this with regard to the three different schools that we spoke of, the non-dualists. There are people who are not very devotional, who don't have much of a belief in a personal God, that it sounds very superstitious, that God did this and God did that, and I'm praying to God. Why will I? Half the people are praying for one team to win, half for the other team to win. The baseball game, right? So what happened? They prayed better, the half that team won, So for a lot of people, these ideas are childlike ideas. They want to have this infinite absolute reality. For them, it's very appropriate. There are some people who like to think that this God is that highest reality, and God has created me. He created me in his image. Let me worship that God. Let me bow down before that God. Let me be the servant of that God. Other people like to think that, no, I'm part of God. I lie on the lap of God. I want to have that close relationship. So he saw that all of these were equally true, these different schools of Vedanta, equally true from this point of view of being representing a spiritual path. Sri Ramakrishna was very fond of explaining this in terms of a statement that was made by the great devotee of Rama by the name of Hanuman, who happened to be a monkey. He was a monkey who represents the ideal of service. The ideal, if we want to take the attitude of being a servant of God, then this Hanuman is the ideal. Rama asked Hanuman once, Hanuman, how do you look upon me? So Hanuman said, well, it's not such an easy question, because sometimes I think of myself in different terms. We all throughout the day, we don't take the same attitude towards ourselves. Sometimes more body consciousness. Sometimes we're in meditation. We're thinking I am the Atman and this and that. So he said, yes, there's some times when I'm identified with his body. He had a strong monkey body, very powerful. He said, when I think of myself as this body, then I like to think that you're the master and I'm the servant. I like that attitude. It appeals to me very much. Then he said, but Rama, sometimes I think of myself more as a jiva, as the soul, the living soul. That means that self within identified with this personality. He said, at that time, I like to think that you're the whole and I'm a part of you. He said, that attitude appeals to me very much. Then he said, but sometimes I think of myself as the Atman. I think of myself as that higher self, that infinite ultimate reality. At that time, I don't see any distinction between the two of us. You and I are one and the same. This is my final, most mature opinion. So Sri Ramakrishna used to quote that very often. These different schools of Vedanta can be seen in terms of different ways that we relate to ourselves. It depends on how I look upon myself. When we have this body consciousness, then we feel some sense of separation. But Sri Ramakrishna also said that the ultimate truth is oneness. That this feeling of separation, he used to explain, as being something like a stick that's lying on the surface of the water. And he talked about this stick as the stick of ego. Because that ego is lying on the surface of the water, we see one side on one side of the stick, another side on the other side of the stick, and we make a distinction. And we can say, I'm on this side, God is on that side. I'm on this side, other living beings are on that side. But we know in reality that a stick has no power to divide the water. It's one body of water. So he also said that all of these different spiritual paths and in oneness. And this is the other way that he harmonized these different philosophical positions, seeing them as stages. Swami Vivekananda himself liked this idea and at one time wanted to write a whole big treatise on it. When he was in the West, he wrote some letters requesting these different commentaries to be sent to him so he could show the reconciliation of them. And he wanted to do it in terms of stages, that this dualistic position can be helpful in the beginning, but it'll reach a stage of qualified non-dualism, and ultimately from the position of oneness, we can see the truth of all of these different positions. So we see, even in his discussion of devotion in Bhakti Yoga, Swami Vivekananda says, we all start as dualists in the path of devotion. God is there, we're here. We want to have some direct experience of God, some union with God. That longing brings us closer and closer till we feel that we're part of God. Then we get closer till we feel that we've established union with God, two in one, then even that distinction vanishes, and we feel merged, one with God. So we have these different ways of looking at these different traditions. Sri Ramakrishna also talks about going up to the roof. When we get to the roof, then we see this ultimate truth, and we see that all of them lead us to that same truth. Now, let me just close, because it's time to close, with one final quote. Swamiji was afraid that we'd have time left over, but somehow... That means I'm enjoying myself. So, anyhow, let me just close with another beautiful quote from Swami Vivekananda. This is from The Ideal of a Universal Religion, and we'll see very clearly this nice harmony between the philosophical side and the mystical side. Lastly, it is imperative that all these various yogas should be carried out in practice. Mere theories about them will not do any good. First, we have to hear about them. Then we have to think about them. We have to reason the thoughts out, impress them on our minds, and we have to meditate on them, realize them, until at last they become our whole life. No longer will religion remain a bundle of ideas or theories, nor an intellectual assent. It will enter into our very self. By means of intellectual assent, we may today subscribe to many foolish things and change our minds altogether tomorrow. But true religion never changes. Religion is realization, not talk, nor doctrine, nor theories, however beautiful they may be. It is being and becoming, not hearing or acknowledging. It is the whole soul becoming changed into what it believes. That is religion. Thank you.